Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the first part of a two-part conversation with Métis storyteller and the current Montana Poet Laureate, Chris Latray, author of Becoming Little Shell, A Landless Indian's Journey Home. Writes David Troyer of Chris's memoir, Becoming Little Shell is a moving, deeply felt, and incredibly detailed account of Chris Latray's search for his origins among the Métis, Pembina, and Little Shell tribe of Chippewa Indians. Combining memoir, history, interviews, and travel, Latray gives us nothing less than the history of a people in the form of an absorbing and emotionally searing memoir. Chris, thank you so much for being here. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
There are 7 reservations in Montana, 12 tribal nations. Your memoir's title is Becoming Little Shell, A Landless Indian's Journey Home. So will you kind of lay the foundation for this conversation? Who are the Little Shell Chippewa and who are the Métis?
The Little Shell Chippewa are the most recently federally restored tribe in the United States. So we received our federal restoration in December of 2019 after, you know, more than 150 years as being known as the landless Indians. So we're number 574.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the Métis, we are an indigenous cultural group recognized in Canada, but not recognized at all in the United States, even though we're the same people. You know, our shared territory straddles the border. And as I say, every time I get a chance to talk about it, we didn't cross the border crossed us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Little Shell Chippewa are largely comprised of Métis people because we come from what was known as the Pembina Chippewa, you know, back in the early, you know, late 1700s into the mid 1800s. Before that land and the people were broken up and we were disenrolled and became a diaspora, we're essentially the same people as the Turtle Mountain Chippewa in North Dakota. And, you know, that's where we were disenrolled, and the book tells the story of how that all happened. But, you know, the Métis, you know, a lot of people don't know about us, you know, because we've been largely erased. And, you know, the goal of this book is to hopefully change some of that.
Yeah, and you speak to that erasure broadly throughout the book, too. The subtitle of your book is A Landless Indian's Journey Home, and you just spoke to this idea of diaspora.
Uh-huh.
But will you clarify for our listeners what you mean by landless? How did the Métis, or specifically the Little Shell Chippewa, how did they become landless? What does that mean in context to our state's history, and maybe contextualize it within the tribal nations that are in Montana now?
Sure. Well, I just like to pose that question for anybody listening. It's like what kind of society do we live in where any indigenous people can be considered landless in the first place?
Sure.
And that speaks to the history of how the United States has dealt with indigenous people. So depending on what date you start with, I start with 1863 with a treaty called the Treaty of Old Crossing. And that was, you know, our Little Shell's father was also known as Little Shell. So Little Shell's a hereditary title. And his father was someone who was part of the negotiation of that treaty, which happened in Minnesota and ultimately created all of the Ojibwe reservations in Minnesota. And he originally signed that treaty in 1863. And when it went back to Washington, D.C., they made a bunch of changes. And he said, look, that's not what I agreed to. I'm not going to sign the subsequent official treaty, and I will never sign anything with you people again. I kind of choose that date, that particular negotiation is kind of the first domino that fell to ultimately cost us our land. And you know, we fast forward into the early 1870s when our little Shell, who we're named after, becomes the hereditary chief of the Pemina Chippewa, and he negotiates the creation of the Turtle Mountain Reservation in the early 1880s. And then it's 1892 when this thing called the 10-cent treaty happened, and that is the kind of the ultimate blow that they made a list literally of people who were Turtle Mountain Chippewa, and they said, well, you weren't willing to cooperate with us, so we're going to take you off that list and basically make you people who don't exist as far as we're concerned. And that's how we became landless. We weren't allowed to stay on the Turtle Mountain Reservation, and we had nowhere else to go. So we became this diaspora, either creating communities in Montana or living on the fringes of them. So often we would create a community, and then settlers would come in and kind of take that over, and we were pushed out to the fringes again.
What's the relationship between the Little Shell Chippewa and, say, like the Rocky Boy Reservation?
So a lot of our relatives on Rocky Boy, particularly those of Chippewa descent, are also Pemina Chippewa. Mm-hmm. So we are deeply related to those folks. And if you wanted to have the simplest answer that you could give as to who the Little Shell are, is we are all the people who didn't fit when they created the Rocky Boy Reservation in, what was it, 1918, I think, or 1916. It's like 1916, or I think it's 1918, you know. So that reservation was created to give a home to all of these landless people who were living on the fringes of communities, but it wasn't big enough. Not everybody who needed a place fit. So, you know, it's an easy answer to say the Little Shell are those people who didn't fit.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Métis. You are a culture that is indigenous, but also comes from very direct European descent and fur traders, right, in the region?
Yes.
Is that too broad a distinction, or you're giving me a look? How would you better describe the Métis?
I always have that look on my face, Lauren. Don't take it personally.
I take everything personally.
Well, what I like to say about, you know, we say fur traders, and you know, when we say fur trader, we actually think of the person who's actually out doing the fur trapping and trading, where we were the ones who were doing that. And it was the Métis result from the first European, we can call them traders because they built trading posts and things like that, who came into the Red River Valley, which is currently, so like the original Red River settlement is Winnipeg, Manitoba. So the city of Winnipeg is where that settlement was.
Okay.
And when those folks came and the Hudson's Bay Company was established, Rupert's Land, in the late 1600s, that's when those folks first started coming over. And in order to trade with the indigenous tribes there, it had to be a familial relationship. So those folks married into indigenous families through marrying indigenous women. And so that was to establish the trade relationship, which was beneficial to both sides. You know, they wanted what we were able to provide, and we wanted what they were able to provide. And the women had a lot of agency in that.
Sure.
And for the first 100 years, everybody was fat and happy. And the children who resulted from those initial marriages and then the intermarriages between them created the Métis people with a specific, not just mixed cultural heritage, but mixed, you know, cultural attributes as far as like music and you know, all the things that we benefited from coming over from the other side of the ocean, mixed with our generations upon generations upon generations of indigenous culture and ability to survive and all of those things. So it was this blend, but unique with its own language and all of the things that anthropologists say comprise a distinct culture we have. So Canada, like our flag flew before the Canadian flag. So we predate Canada in that region. And, you know, I think it's political reasons why the United States doesn't recognize who we are, because then they have to come to terms with another large group of people that they took stuff from that they have to reconcile, and they're not willing to do that.
This memoir is about you and your family as much as it is about the broader context of the Little Shell Tribe and the Métis. Your grandfather's and your father's deaths sort of catalyzed you learning about more thoroughly your heritage, your journey to enrollment, your journey to learn more about where you came from. But both were Indigenous men who decidedly and very completely ignored their indigeneity. Who did you grow up believing yourself to be? Who were you when you were growing up in light of that self-erasure?
My dad denied it vehemently. You know, I can hardly remember any conversations with my grandfather. I didn't know him very well, even though, you know, we would go visit and stuff. He just didn't have a lot of attention for the grandkids, I guess. Mm. But grandma said we were Chippewa. So grandma's the boss. So what grandma says, that's what I'm going to believe. And, you know, as a kid, it's just one of those weird, you know, discrepancies of adults where dad says one thing, grandma says something else, and I just knew I shouldn't ask dad about it because he would get angry if we suggested that we were Indian, you know. Mm. But grandma was open about it. And so that's why I chose to identify as Chippewa, because A, grandma said so, and B, I thought Indians were cool.
Yeah.
You know, when we played cowboys and Indians, I wanted to be an Indian because I was one.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a great story. One of our Métis elders in Helena, Dan Pocha, one time he and I did a talk together at the Helena Middle School in front of like 600 kids or something like that. And he talked about growing up Métis and that, you know, he was the only one in his class who could play cowboys and Indians with himself. And I love that line. But yeah, I always identified as Indian. And it wasn't until I got into my 30s and 40s that I really doubled down on trying to figure out what that meant.
Mm-hmm. You write in the memoir's introduction that you were, quote, not alone in trying to find your way back to who you were all along, a proud Indian. Pride must have been a very complicated feeling when you've lived an entire life with your father, who sort of denied that heritage specifically, who had the opposite feeling of being a Native man. And yet your pride in your indigeneity seemed to come easy for you, even at a young age. How did that pride, Chris, guide you on this journey to enrollment and to learning more about your heritage? And how has it maybe not changed or become something else, but how has that pride become more nuanced?
I don't know that pride was the guide for it. Hmm. Pride was just the air that I breathed as I got deeper into learning who I was.
I love that.
It was just there, and it just became part of me because I started learning just how magnificent my ancestors were.
Yeah.
And what they sacrificed so that I could be here. And that's important, and it's not exclusive to Métis people or Little Shell people. That is almost inherent in my generation, you know, the fact that we are living in a time when it is certainly less dangerous, you know, unless you're woman or two-spirit and the whole MMIP thing. But, you know, like people like me, you know, my dad grew up in an era when, you know, in central Montana, there were signs in stores and things that said no breeds allowed, referring to, you know, the derogatory term of calling us breeds or half-breeds. And you know, and he was living in that first generation removed from boarding schools and how that just totally reconfigured family life and self-esteem and the generational trauma that gets passed down. I mean, what was living in him? I'm amazed he was as good a father as he was. And he was. You know, he certainly had his failings, as I do.
We all do.
You know, as a father or a person or whatever. But, you know, he lived in a generation much different from mine. And, you know, as I came to know where we came from and what we represented in that region for, you know, a couple hundred years, that was where the pride came from.
Hmm.
It was just there in the air waiting to be inhaled. And now, you know, even interacting with other Indigenous people, like I'm involved in a number of different, you know, councils, for lack of a better word, you know, groups getting together, like a part of a group working with the national park, the Yellowstone National Park folks to re-indigenize Yellowstone. It's like I represent the Little Shell for that. And, you know, there was a time when I thought, well, I need to just kind of sit back because all these other people are elders and they're from these other tribes and whatever. And then, you know, over time I realized, you know, I know as much about my people and where we come from as any of the people in this room. And I am technically an elder in my tribe as well. I have ground to stand on as an equal to anybody. And that's important. And that's pride too. That's pride in your position of who you represent as a group of folks who, even though we didn't sign all these treaties that kind of shaped Montana, whether it's the Fort Laramie Treaty or the Lame Bull Treaty that created the Blackfeet Reservation, or even the Hellgate Treaty of 1855 right here, right outside of Missoula, which I say is the second most important thing to ever happen in this valley, second only to the draining of Lake Missoula, you know, 15,000 years ago, because of how it shapes our day-to-day life, every moment of every day, today. You know, it's going on outside our doors right now, the reverberations of that treaty negotiation. We were there, you know. We were part of all of these things. I can tell you who was at Lame Bull and who was at Fort Laramie. It was a guy named Broken Arm, who was our little shell's uncle. So one of those things that people don't realize is how much conversation and relationship was happening among the tribes as all of these things were happening. They weren't isolated incidents. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew what was going on, and everybody knew what the ramifications of these negotiations were going to be, mm-hmm. or potentially. So it's not like you could go to Shodo and people in Great Falls don't really know what's being talked about. Those Great Falls folks were in Shodo. You know, that's the analogy. So yeah, we were part of it. And I, you know, as a member of the most recently federally recognized tribe that people don't necessarily have heard about, it's time for us to kind of reestablish our position, because we were always important.
You're listening to a conversation with Métis storyteller Chris Latray. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Montana Book Company, located in downtown Helena, Montana since 1978, offering new books for all ages, vinyl records, and community activism. Delivery in Helena and shipping is available online at mtbookco.com. You're using the term reverberation, right? That these historical events, these treaties that were signed and then ignored, they have reverberations in this valley, across the state, across the country. Let's talk about those reverberations. Like, how do we see those effects today? I think it's an easy jump to blood quantum if you want to go in that direction, but let's clarify for our listeners what you mean. Again, how are these effects felt or seen now? That's a broad question.
It is, and I'm happy you asked it, because to me the reverberations are, well, first, you know, Missoula is a wealthy community. There's money tucked away in little pockets of this town that I think would blow people's minds. Every bit of wealth, not just in our community, but in North America, every bit of wealth that anybody has, the source of that wealth is the taking of indigenous access to, I hate to use the word resources, but that's the easiest way to understand it. Land and resources, that's what it's always been about. Mm-hmm. So all of our wealth here in this valley is the result of the fact that in 1855, they pulled the Salish out and shoved them to the north, thinking that, you know, that would be out of sight, out of mind. And now everybody benefits from access to all of this stuff we have in Missoula. And so those, you know, the reverberations there are just the fact that you have these folks that have been marginalized by settler colonialism on the fringe of everything good that is happening, everything good. And I use air quotes for that, because is it? You know, if we think of how close to destruction we've driven ourselves in the last 200 years by living in a way that we did not live as people on this earth for thousands of years. So that's one reverberation. Another one is just the circular nature of time and how we continue to do the same things over and over. And we can, in Missoula, we can talk about the houseless crisis. Mm-hmm. And our recent decision by our city council to approve this measure to kind of push all of the houseless people, which is an epidemic here as it is in Bozeman and Billings and Portland and Seattle, this epidemic of houseless people living in parks and parking lots and all of these things. And what are we going to do with those folks? And I don't see losers and drug addicts and drunks and all of the things that you see in the comment sections of newspapers anytime there's an article about that. I see the current version of who my people were for 150 years because, you know, 100 years ago, that was us who had lost everything through no fault of our own. Same with a lot of our houseless people. You have veterans who we like to trumpet, oh, we're, you know, for our veterans and blah, 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 but we don't take care of them. So many of them come back with mental health issues or physical health issues and addictions because of what they experienced serving our country, and we don't do anything to take care of them. You have people working multiple jobs, but they can't afford to live in the town where they work, which we were. You know, we were cowboys and sheep herders and had all of these jobs that we did because we were the best ones to do that job, yet we weren't allowed to live in the community where we did those jobs. The list goes on, and it's just the same. And if you look at newspapers from 100 years ago, you see the same kind of comments. Mm. And, you know, I spoke at the 50-year anniversary of the Poverello Center being the homeless shelter in Missoula. And, like, days after the city council passed that ordinance, which went into effect the day we had this huge thunderstorm that wiped out, you know, shut the whole city down for several days. Mm-hmm. Where are those folks supposed to go in those situations? But I take that personally. I take the way we treat our houseless people personally. And I get so aggravated in Missoula with our self-righteousness and our land acknowledgments. You know, we're going to live and steward the land the way that the Salish people did who were here first. And I say, really? Because the Salish people, you know, one person didn't have five homes and somebody had nothing. One person didn't have all the food while other people starved. You know, everybody had a home. If somebody had food, everybody ate until that food was gone. Until we want to at least try and live in our society like that, shut your mouth about land acknowledgments because you're not really even trying. Here I am on a roll getting all fired up, Lauren.
You're getting fired
up. I'm sorry.
No.
But that is how it is. That is the reverberation. That is the circular nature of time that in this just rapacious settler colonialism and capitalism at the first almost cult that we have of not taking care of each other, where we just funnel wealth to this tiny percentage of people that don't care about anybody but themselves until we correct that, which is how we lived for thousands of years. Until we decide we want to live differently in our modern culture, it's just going to keep happening. And who it affects, just that level rises and rises and rises. And people 20 years ago who thought they would never be touched by it because they were middle class or upper middle class. Now they're all of a sudden saying, well, I can't afford to live here. It's like, well, welcome to the last 500 years for a big chunk of the folks who are already here.
You're talking about landlessness, you're talking about houselessness here in Missoula. You do a really stunning job in your memoir, Chris, of drawing these comparisons, not only, again, to the landless and houseless. I'm wondering, Chris, in writing this memoir, in going on these journeys of discovering your heritage, and I can feel the empathy while you're talking, so maybe this is a moot question, but how did these journeys that you've been on, this journey of writing this memoir, discovering your heritage, how did they change the way you see other people? How did they change your empathy?
I think I've always been pretty empathetic, but I think the same air that I was breathing of pride made me recognize just the relationship we have with each other. Hmm. And part of that is the realization of how related all of the tribes in Montana are. So, you know, there are Little Shell people living on every reservation in Montana, largely because we took refuge, but also because there are Crow people living on all the other reservations. There are Blackfeet people living in all the other reservations. And, you know, you get a group of people together, of intertribal people, and you start comparing family trees. It's like the Kevin Bacon thing, the six degrees of Kevin Bacon. Pretty soon you find a shared ancestor or, you know, or even just a shared community member. Like there's a woman on from Fort Peck who is Nakota or Assiniboine, and she works in their language preservation department or whatever you want to call it. Her mother-in-law is Iris Killeagle, who is a member of the Little Shell Tribal Council. So you've got that relationship. Just earlier this week, I was up in Browning, you know, talking with some language folks up there, and there's a woman who I gave a copy of the book to, and she said her grandfather was Eli Gardapi. And Eli Gardapi is the person who gave the quote to Nicholas Vrooman for the title of his landmark book about the Little Shell, The Whole Country Was One Robe. And Eli Gardapi is the source of that quote about the whole country being one robe. I think he was talking about either his father or his grandfather talking about when there were so many buffalo across the landscape that the whole country was one robe, you know, just this vast herd. And it just looked like one single gigantic animal. And I had no idea that, you know, she is a very important member of the Blackfeet community, yet clearly she has this relationship to us. And there's story after story about that. So that relationship, not just to each other as human animals, but our relationship with our non-human relatives. Mm. You know, so I usually, when I do an event, and the first thing I say is, Buju Indinawe Maganadug. And that is Anishinaabe Moen for hello, which is Buju. And Indinawe Maganadug is all of my relatives. And I say that first to kind of set the tone for how I view our relationship, whether there's 15 of us or 1,000 of us mm-hmm. in that room. And then I like to point out that we are in relationship with each other and everybody else. And everybody, meaning, yeah. Yes, everybody. It's like that windstorm I talked about, this wonderful willow tree that I have shared a yard with for more than 10 years was more than half knocked down by it. And it was traumatic. And, you know, I was out there cleaning up the remains of that tree. And I was thinking, this feels like taking care of the body of a relative who has crossed over. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be part of that. I didn't want somebody else to come up and disappear these remains. I wanted to have a hands-on relationship with that. And that changes when you start thinking like that. I think that changes how you want to interact with the world around you. And, you know, that's a very indigenous concept. And more people, I think, are coming to recognize that. And that's important.
Yeah. And I don't know that many, or I shouldn't maybe be so general, but not all of Missoula will probably contextualize that storm in the way that you have. But it did seem to me that people became aware again of the space that they share, right?
Yes.
Like neighbors became neighbors again. And we all were very, very conscious of, and this sounds so silly maybe, but we were conscious of the trees.
Yeah.
And that's something that we lose in the day-to-day often. And so while we might not contextualize it in the way that you have here. That was Chris Latray, author of the memoir Becoming Little Shell, A Landless Indian's Journey Home, out now from Milkweed Editions. Tune in next week for the second part of my conversation with Chris. And to learn more about Chris, head to mtpr.org, where you can also listen to my live conversation with him during Montana Public Radio's Spring 2024 fundraiser. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.